All right, let's kick off our Friday afternoon. We do that with Dennis Stewart and Health Naturally today. Dennis, haven't been able to catch up with you for a while. So
I've missed you, Mark. I've missed you.
That's all right. And we're in for a great hour or so, aren't we, for Health Naturally today?
Of course we are.
Now, last week you did open a discussion. See, I was paying attention. You sort of kicked
off
on functional foods, and you sort of did cover one particularly bit of melon. Later on, we'll sort of open up discussion again on functional foods. So what are they? And we'll also take a look at a couple more that can sort of help us out as well. So that sounds pretty good.
Fascinating topic. I lectured on it years ago in a topic that I taught to my students called Food for Medicine. And it was probably one of the most successful one-semester courses I ever taught.
All right.
And I still fall back on the references that I used in that course.
That saves having to come up with new ones, doesn't it?
It does.
Measure once, cut twice. Is that the way? Have I got that the right way around?
Well, it's pretty close.
Measure once, cut twice.
Pretty close.
All right. No, measure twice, cut once. If you cut twice.
Well, either way. Either way. This time of the day, either way.
Yeah. You know what I mean anyway.
Yes, of course.
As he continues his discussion from last week on functional foods. Dennis, a bit of a recap to start with. How would one define a functional food?
A functional food is...
One that makes you full?
that could be a side effect of it. But a functional food is a food that is used and used increasingly as something that not just supports nutrition, but can also address various diseases. So a functional food is essentially using food as a medicine. There's nothing new in this, Mark. It goes right back to Hippocrates. It said food is your best medicine. And that's coming into its own, and listeners on this program over the years would have heard me mention the work of the two French-Canadians, Belliveau and Gingras, the writing of their book, Foods That Fight Cancer, an incredibly scientific and credible work by those two PhDs. That is probably one of the best examples of what functional foods can do. I encourage that book to be read by anyone in any aspect of healthcare who's interested in the way in which foods, not particular diets, the way in which foods, individual or in combination, can address pretty serious diseases. And I touched on that last week, and listeners might say, well, look, if this is the case, why isn't it more widely used or accepted? Two reasons. I think the modern Western model of healthcare is structured around a diagnosis of a disease and a script or a surgical recommendation to fix it. And I'm not opposed to that, but I'm concerned that the understanding within mainstream medicine that frequently a disease that is diagnosed by a good GP or specialist can be very well managed, sometimes better by encouraging the person who's suffering from a condition to start to encourage the eating in particular amounts of a food or certain foods. And there is nothing new in this. It's in the literature. But the modern model that we've accepted in the West doesn't encourage that. Plus the fact, Mark, that there's no money in it for pharmaceutical companies. Pharmaceutical companies depend upon drugs, desire drugs, and depend upon developing a market for those. And our medical practitioners are largely trained and skilled and schooled in using pharmaceutical medications as probably the only therapy that they feel confident to recommend. Now, we're not talking about dietetic information here. We're talking about looking at simple foods and saying to a person, look, if you've got a bowel condition characterized by bleeding and it's been investigated, there's no cancer, but periodically you're bleeding from the bowel, there's a bit of inflammation there, why not recommend to that person that the taking and the drinking of cabbage juice in the literature has a styptic effect on the wall of the bowel due to its what's called vitamin U factor, strong content of vitamin K, written up in some medical documents as a treatment for that sort of bleeding that has been well screened and shown not to be associated with sinister conditions, but is characterised by embarrassment, frequency, and not resolving to steroid treatment or anything else. One can talk about many foods with that potential that could be recommended. it may be not fancy for a GP to recommend to someone, look, there's a bit of information around suggesting that the regular healthy use of something like cabbage, which we talked about earlier this year, may have a useful effect on this problem of excessive bleeding. You've been screened by your doctor, your specialist, you have no polyps, you have no inflammation, you just periodically bleed. This could be useful to try.
All right, and we will have a look at some more functional foods, particularly in and around gout and type 2 diabetes. Well,
gout.
Been into those very shortly. Not gout the runner, but gout the gout. A couple of weeks to go before you'll be off on your Christmas break. I have to ask you, I mean, are you doing anything exciting over the holidays?
Well, I haven't really reached holidays yet. I don't know what a holiday is, Mark, but never mind. Probably I will visit my great-grandchildren on the Central Coast. Maybe do one or two other things, but not much.
All right.
A time of rest, relaxation. Not much. I'm not as flamboyant as what I perhaps should be or used to be. I'm quite happy to be an ageing, wise old man.
Yeah, and still waiting for you, by the way. I haven't seen you in here for a few months, so we're waiting for you for those photos of your in the 60s.
Yes, I'm still trying to rustle them up without embarrassing you.
I'm not in them. So now let's get back to our functional foods. Yeah, and this time around, type 2 diabetes, we know that is something that in many parts of the community is somewhat rife. How can we apply a functional food to that?
Well, look, I spoke last week at some length about the food that's used universally around the world, particularly in South Asia and in South America. And we spoke about the food bitter melon, which is readily available here now in our food stores, and sometimes even in our supermarkets. Ethnic people thrive on it. I've eaten it. Some of my patients have showed me how to prepare dishes. It's also available, fortunately, for some listeners who may not like the taste of it or feel a bit reserved about it. As you would expect, it is now available in an encapsulated form. Yes, an encapsulated form or a tableted form. And I'm not going to criticise that because I would rather see people with type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance using it in any form, even if it means using it as a tablet, a capsule or a powder. But it's such a simple and inexpensive food that it worries me that we might be bypassing the food.
Well, you've said in the past, and this sort of hit me like a punch in the face. You were like, a lot of times it is the taste and texture of something.
Yes.
That hitting our senses is a huge part of it. But if I've just looked up bitter melon, we've got our research team on this, and if you're not sure what it is, it is an annual climbing vine that produces a highly bitter cucumber-shaped fruit, also known as bitter gourd or balsam pear.
It's not a bad definition.
And apparently used a lot in stir fries and curries.
Exactly.
So there you go. I mean, you can just put it in something else that you do like.
And that's how it's used predominantly in South Asia or India. And it can be made into quite a nice dish, but Australians are very, very reluctant to change into foods that they've not previously eaten, which I think's a shame. The good thing about bitter melon is...
I started young on pizza. I did all right.
Oh, did you? Okay, we won't go there. But it grows so well. It grows like a cucumber. And that's why a lot of our ethnic people grow it and thrive on it. But it is universally recognised as a good natural medicine to treat, particularly type 2 diabetes, or help treat it, even in conjunction with first-line medications such as metformin. So I mentioned that. But I want to move on today and talk about another functional food, which I've had a case that categorically justifies its claim to be a functional food. I want to talk about the way in which a particular food, simple cherry, either as a fruit or as a juice, can have, by now, a well-known way and a well-known history of helping lessen gout episodes and helping resolve them, particularly stubborn gout conditions, when even the standard drugs, allopurinol, colchicine, the anti-inflammatories, when even they are not holding the condition, steroids, when they're not holding the condition, the use of cherry, even in small amounts, can work preventatively and work episodically. Now, in a book that I used during my teaching career in the teaching of food as your best medicine or food therapy, I used a book, but I'll go slowly this because I know listeners are interested in what references I use, but I used a book entitled The Food Pharmacy by the American writer Jean Carper, C-A-R-P-E-R, an excellent work. It's not too technical, but on page 162 of that book, she talks about the use of cherry and said this statement: in ancient Greece, physicians prescribed cherries for multiple things. She goes on to say, in 1950, Ludwig Blau, a PhD in the United States, wrote an article in the paper Texas Reports on Biology and Medicine and claimed that he'd cured his crippling gout that had confined him to a wheelchair by eating 6 to 8 cherries each day.
Now, that's not exactly a lot, is it?
Not a lot. And there is debate on it, but I can't question the reference. That wouldn't be ethical, and this is a reliable text. The writer goes on to say, as long as he ate cherries, the gout stayed away. He had no scientific explanation for his discovery, but he noted that at least 12 other people who ate cherries or drank cherry juice also cured their gout. And Prevention magazine printed his advice, and since then, dozens of people have written into that well-known magazine attesting the benefit of cherries taken regularly in their diet as a preventative or prophylactic agent. And I had a remarkable example of this. One thing about doing this program and sharing my experiences with people is to support my contention that what I say is truth. Now, when I talk about gout, people say, oh, yeah, what I mean, it talks about cherries helping gout. Come on. I'll tell you something. I saw probably the worst case of gout that many general practitioners would ever have seen. And this is recorded on my cards at New Lambton. A gentleman sitting in the coffee shop across from my rooms was encouraged by his comrade to come over and have a talk to us because he had gout in his big toe, which had not responded to all the medical treatments that could be thrown at it. And I mean the colchicine, the anti-inflammatories, allopurinol, and even oral steroids, and finally the injection of steroid into this hideously swollen and painful big toe. The worst part about it was he'd booked his flight to go to Indonesia on a fishing trip. He was a wealthy man. So reluctantly he came across the road, and I'd never seen gout in such a state as this, and I went through it with him, and he told me that he'd exhausted everything, and you're not going to believe this, but it's true. The last option was that he should have his toe amputated. Mm. And at that point, he panicked. So he came over, and he poured in a storm. I gave him a preparation that contained a concentrate of gout together with a couple of Blackmore's minerals. Within a matter of a couple of days, if not a week, his foot was comfortable, the toe had resumed its normal configuration, and more importantly, he was able to go on his fishing trip to Indonesia, and he came back and couldn't come through the door more quickly to thank me for the incredible treatment. Now, people might doubt a lot of what I say. You can't doubt an example there where someone had exhausted the whole gamut of treatment, was faced with amputation, the loss of his prepaid trip to Indonesia, and going on to this folklore remedy, which fortunately these days has a significant amount of pharmacological evidence behind it, justifying its effect on uric acid and the resolution of inflammation.
Yeah, I'd be more interested to see what he caught when he was on that trip, but never mind. G'day, Jerry. You're on the Central Coast of Terrigal. You have a question for Dennis. What's happening, Jerry?
Good morning. Good afternoon to all you guys, and especially Dennis Stewart. You're an amazing man, Dennis. I will disclose I am a client of yours, but I always listen to your program, but I've just got something really quickly to say that I recently watched an Insight program on SBS.
Oh, yes.
With Kumi Taguchi, and they had the president of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners on, and they had Chinese Herald. That was an amazing program. I just want to say to you, I'm really disappointed in our society that we don't believe in the amazing work that you do. There was one lady, and I'll be brief, there was one lady who tried to get pregnant for 10 years doing IVF. She went to a herbalist. She was pregnant in 3 months.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me. I taught that formula. I've taught it all round the English-speaking world and to so many practitioners. And despite the scepticism, I can put it up on the screen, but I'm not good at doing it, of a recent case of a young lady. She wasn't young. She was a bit older than that. She drives trucks in the mines. Up around Singleton, lovely woman, a typical coalfields lady, and she's married to a giant of a man. She's not a big lady, but he's a big man, and I think he's a diesel fitter. And they came to see me, and they'd spent a lot of money, a lot of time, and were finally faced with the medical diagnosis that she should forget about it. There was no way that she'd be able to have a child, and that lady broke down in my rooms and said, Mr. Stewart, all we want is one child. Well, I've got photographs of that one child. I'm holding it together with that couple in my rooms. The sad thing about it is, even though I have taught the fundamental constituents of that medicine, which has helped so many over my 50 years, it's still not in any way accepted in any credible form.
And I'll be brief and close with this, and thank you. And I just want to say, why are we so convinced with general practitioners and the medical system when there are alternatives? I recently had a conversation with a specialist, and I said I had great belief in you and I had great belief in herbal. And she said to me, and I'll quote, look, why don't you go and get a few sticks and throw them around? This is what we're dealing with in our world. I'm not saying that general practitioners can't do good things. Of course they do. Yeah. But so do wonderful people like you. And why doesn't the government do something about it?
Well, my response to that would be, I would see that comment by that practitioner as being very ignorant. And what I would say is, look, in my career, the number of practitioners, specialist practitioners, such as a gastroenterologist that I taught in Melbourne in one of my postgraduate courses, to many, many general practitioners I've taught, many of whom use natural medicine in their practice with all the reservations associated with their being able to do it. I think it really gets back to a culture, and a lot of doctors can be marginalised, I suspect, if they develop a reputation for being a good herbalist or naturopath as well as a good GP. I have great fondness for my medical colleagues, and very rarely would you hear me say anything adversely about them. I respect them. I have a good GP myself, and my wife has had good surgeons during her life. But I'm disappointed to hear comments like that, because to me, that indicates gross ignorance. Gross ignorance.
Good times, great music, and Health Naturally with Dennis Stewart. He is here, 49216. So let's get back into some of our calls now. Heading all the way overseas to Stockton, and Michael, good afternoon, Michael. How can Dennis have a crack at helping you today?
Oh, good afternoon, Dennis. How are you?
I'm well, Michael. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good, good.
I was wondering if you might be able to help me. I have rosacea.
Yes.
On Roaccutane. I was wondering if there's a natural alternative to Roaccutane.
How long have you been on Roaccutane?
Probably about 6 years.
Okay, and you've not reacted to it in any way?
No, other than dries out your lips and your nose and the like.
Yeah. Look, for the sake of listeners, Roaccutane is a drug that is prescribed for things like acne rosacea, serious acne across the board. It can sometimes be quite remarkable. Unfortunately, it can have a side effect, but sometimes the condition for which it's used warrants the risk of using the medication, because skin conditions can be very disfiguring, very disconcerting, and very stubborn to treat. And anything that can lessen the scarring, the embarrassment, the redness, the inflammation is worthwhile. So Roaccutane, when prescribed and monitored by a dermatologist, a specialist particularly, has proven itself to be a very useful substance, and therefore I'm not going to knock it. I understand your concern and your intention to get off it. I'll mention two things that might be useful to take in conjunction with it that may give some indication of benefit, encouraging you then to discuss modifying the medication with your specialist, but under no circumstances alter it until you have had a discussion with him. I always recommend for inflammatory skin conditions, and particularly rosacea, but more so eczema and dermatitis, I always recommend the use of evening primrose oil capsules. Now, you can look at it in the literature and you'll find that it has a useful documentation for inflammatory conditions, particularly of the skin and the face included. So I always encourage people with any skin condition to try that medication. It's a supplement. It's more of a food. And I'm not aware of it having any capacity to interact with Roaccutane, although the ethical thing to do would be to mention it to your medical managers. The other thing that I would recommend is that, particularly for rosacea and facial rosacea, there is what's called a homeopathic medicine. Now, homeopathic medicine, for the sake of listeners, it is a medicine prescribed in a very minute dosage, and it is prescribed in that form because if it were taken in a macro dose, it could in fact aggravate the very condition for which it's used in what's called a homeopathic potency. Now, the preparation is just known as sanguinaria. I'll spell it for you. S-A-N-G-U-A-N-A-R-I-A, sanguinaria. And it's in what's called in homeopathic language, and we do have some practitioners of homeopathy in Newcastle, a lot more in Sydney, and some of them would be medical practitioners. I knew two brilliant medical practitioners in Sydney who went on to study herbal medicine with me at Glebe. But sanguinaria and what is referred to as the 6C potency. Now, I know that sounds very esoteric and very otherworldly. A lot of people are sceptical of homeopathy because it defies a lot of modern attempts to explain it. It's fair to say that it is one of the oldest forms of natural medicine, and in Europe, it is a very, very popular system of medicine. And in France, I believe, it's part of the national health scheme as far as medications are concerned. Some of the best literature that I've read on homeopathy and lectured from have been based on homeopathic practitioners from France. So that's worthwhile thinking about. It would have no capacity to interact with Roaccutane because of its homeopathic dilution. And if you were to Google that preparation, you would see that it has, if you like, a lot of characteristics of rosacea, particularly the inflammatory red skin condition that it's characterised by. There are two things for you to think around, but under no circumstances depart from what you're doing, because that's at least held the condition for you. But look at those two options. I'd discuss them with your doctors, but I'm sure there would be no problem with them because A, one is a nutritional supplement, and B, is a homeopathic preparation, which in its minute dosage would be impossible to interact with that particular medication.
Best of luck with everything there, Michael. We'll continue with Marie at Clarencetown. Marie, you have a question on heart health for Dennis. What's going on, Marie?
Oh, hi, how are you?
Well, thank you, Marie.
Oh, that's good. I was just wondering, I've got diastolic dysfunction, and I was just wondering if, like, celery tablets or something like that would help with that.
No, celery tablets would have no benefit whatsoever in managing that. Has your doctor got you on appropriate medication?
No, I had a reaction to the medication he gave me, so I'm not on anything.
So how characterised is this condition? How frequently? Is it troubling you all the time?
No, I mean, I have chest pain, but it's mild to moderate.
Okay.
So it's gone from mild to moderate. I'm actually skipping a beat at the minute, okay. So, but they're not worried about that either. So, he said that it could be just an ectopic,
okay. Look,
something or other.
A herbalist would always fall back on the broad spectrum benefits of the herb known as hawthorn berry. Now, fortunately, it's more of a food than a medication, albeit most of the preparations of hawthorn berry come in a modern natural drug form, tablets or capsules, in regulated dosage. It's very, very safe to use. Again, I take that seriously in saying that, okay, I declare it safe, but if one were to use it, the right thing to do would be to run it past your medical manager so that at least you get the nod from that. But if you look at the literature, the natural medicine literature, the pharmacopoeias, the British Herbal Pharmacopoeia of 1983, you will find that it has a fairly good reference. The best term that could be used would be that it is a heart tonic in the best gentle sense, which is used for its regulatory capacity and its antagonism to certain diseases, not particularly yours, but things like, for instance, angina. It's a very good herb for helping manage episodes of that. Hawthorn berry is a good start.
Oh, okay, terrific. I got rid of my cholesterol using garlic, honey and apple cider vinegar.
Well, of course you would. Worked. Of course you would. garlic was something that I was going to get onto today, but anyone that's not using garlic or onion to try to control their cholesterol is missing out on a mountain of credible information. So congratulations. Yeah. Encouragement will be listened to by many today. There'll be a big rush for the food stores to get onto garlic.
It was high and it's come back down. I'm in the normal range now.
Good on you. Well done, Marie.
Just don't breathe on anybody, Marie. Just don't breathe near me. You'll be fine. All right, best of luck. You're good to see Dennis and Marie's having some hits there.
Look, she's doing exactly what I encourage people to do, to take responsibility. Don't get hooked on some of the wretched drugs that are so casually thrown at conditions which so frequently can be managed with much safer options.
From Stanford Merthyr now, Lynette, you have I believe this might be a quick one in relation to Dennis talking earlier on diabetes.
Type 2 diabetes, what was the recommendation that you've
done? I mentioned the herb known as bitter melon.
Bitter,
B-I-T-T-E-R, and its botanical name is Momordica, M-O-M-O-R-D-A, Momordica. Charanta, Charanta, Momordica charanta, bitter melon. It looks like a long cucumber with ridges down the side of it. It's very bitter, and as a general rule, most herbs that have an effect on blood sugar levels and are used to help type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance have a bitter taste. But the bitter taste can be buffered by doing cooking it in the same way that our Indian colleagues do or our South American colleagues do, and you get plenty of references and good ways of cooking it. I've found it in food stores in Cessnock, in the supermarket there occasionally. It's readily available. Give it a go. I encourage you to do it.
Okay. Is it in, like, the fruit and vegetables?
Yeah, in the fruit stores. You might have to ask or search around, but I have found it, I'm sure, in food stores in the Cessnock region. Certainly it's available in food stores in bigger metropolitan areas where you have a larger ethnic population. But we're getting a significant ethnic population in the Hunter Valley, which I applaud. A lot of them are great Indian people whose system of medicine I've studied, lectured on and practiced. They know a lot about the use of bitter melon.
We are wrapping up Health Naturally with Dennis Stewart. It's been a big one, Dennis. You want to, though, give us some final words on functional food, particularly in relation to gout. So I know we upped that up earlier. Go for it.
Well, we talked about the specific ability of cherries, either eaten as a fruit in small amounts, 5, 6, 7, 8 cherries a couple of times a day, or taking it in an easier form, cherry juice, good quality cherry juice taken from our supermarkets. That is a recommended way. Let me just say that if one regularly suffers gout, one should see the taking of cherry, particularly in cherry juice, as an ongoing thing to lessen the episodes. I've known many patients who have gone off the standard drug, which doctors prescribe preventatively, have gone off it, gone on to cherry juice or cherry extract, and have done well and have noticed the preventative ability. The only other thing is there are some other substances, particularly celery seed extract. That's a great favourite of herbalists in the Western world, and very frequently in modern preparations one will find a concentrate of cherry juice combined with an extract of celery seed.
And in 60 seconds, done well, Dennis. Appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate that, Mark. Coming from you, that really means something.
Yeah, see, what I said 60, I actually could give him 90, but I thought, well, and I'm just sitting back waiting for it to be done. Dennis, always a pleasure. We'll catch you for next time as we get towards the end of 2025 for Health Naturally. As always, it's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure, Mark.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from 2NURFM at the University of Newcastle. Topics range from gardening to health, well-being, pet care, and travel. You'll find them all at 2NURFM.com.